and welcome back to another exciting episode of Extra Featured Interviews. Today we have a fabulous director who I think is his first film, but we're going to get into that. His film, Wait, 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 Don't Kill Me, is what we watched. Adam Lippy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I don't know. How does it feel making your first film?
It's exhausting. It's basically a triumph of the human spirit, in which I didn't triumph and I don't have any human spirit. Is that what we're going with?
Short film.
the whole thing took 7 years. So from conception to completion, which was March of 2020, and the release, which was technically August of this year, and then again on October 23rd of this year. It was a relief initially because it took so long, and, you know, bankruptcy in the middle, you know, running out of money. The shoot took several years. But it's a relief, I guess, is the answer. There's not that much exhilaration, honestly, when you're done with it. It's more like, oh, thank God.
Okay, I want to back this up. 7 years?
Yes.
Okay. And you told me you had a bankruptcy. So how long into the film was the bankruptcy?
So I wrote the first draft in 2013, 2014, and then tried to get the movie made in Philadelphia in 2014 once. Couldn't get the cast that I wanted, then cast it in New York in 2014, but then the locations were too expensive to do in New York, so we just used the same cast and did it in Philadelphia, and we shot 12 days in May and June of 2015, and then ran out of money. We did one pickup, sort of like second unit day in 2015, and then another day in December of 2015, and then we ran out of money somewhere in there, and then didn't shoot again until April of 2017 with the same cast, although not all the same crew, some of the same crew, and then over a period of 8 months, we did 5 shooting days, all pickup days, and then finished shooting December of 2017. Then post-production began in January of 18. And that took a long time because I hired the best people I could find, which means on a low budget that you have to wait while they do their corporate work. So you're kind of, second fiddle, which is totally understandable because I can't pay them the rates that they deserve. And so that took several years, and it finished, even though I know it's a viral pandemic movie, finished the very week that Pennsylvania was shut down in March of 2020.
So as a filmmaker, you're making your film. How did bankruptcy hit you? Like, I mean, were you devastated?
I thought I wouldn't finish it, but I knew that I had to. So I got a corporate job and just earn money, put it away until I could afford shooting days. And then that's the kind of thing where you have to make sacrifices and, you know, eat rice and beans for a couple months and hope that you can get through it. And, you know, there were so many reasons to stop making the movie. It was bad for me physically. It was bad for me mentally. They were all, sometimes an actor can't make it, so you have to double them that day. Sometimes two actors can't make it and there's 4 people in the scene, and so you're doubling 2 people on that day. I don't think it's evident in the movie. You get to a time where there's 1 shooting day. We did 18 sequences on 10 locations, in less than 12 hours, where I'm functioning as writer, producer, director, script supervisor, assistant director, makeup person, property master, and also buying bus tickets in between, shots so the actors can go home to New York. And then we even snuck in ADR that day because we had some basement sequences where we needed some of the main actors to record some audio that would went in. And you'd think that day would like play like a complete rush and bizarre, but we planned it properly. And, we got through it, even though the original bus with the actors coming in that day was an hour late. So we actually had an hour less than we should have. So it can be done, and you would think all that stuff would be a rush, but pretty much all that stuff's in the movie. And I don't think you can tell one way or the other, everything was kind of manic. It was the call sheet from hell. If you ever saw it, it was, I remember we were shooting a sequence and these actors had shown up. This one guy's driven in from New Jersey. And I said, oh, sorry, we're a little late. I had to reorganize things because this didn't work and we had to go here for this. And, this kind of thing is like, I can't believe, you know, you did this and, you know, this call sheet is ridiculous. How did you even think you could squeeze? This is like a week's worth of shooting and you're doing it in one day. And I'm like, I totally understand why you're a couple hours behind. I'm like, yeah, but we'll get your stuff done and you'll be able to go. But, you know, that's what I meant by it's exhausting. Like you just have to finish it because otherwise you won't forgive yourself. And also you never know whether it's the only movie you're ever going to make. And if you just have an unfinished project on your mind, I mean, I tried to raise money any number of different ways and none of them worked. So it just meant, okay, I'll get a job and I'll work through it. I'll get a specific kind of thing that is less mentally taxing. And then I can work on the movie, you know, separate from the 40 hours a week I'm putting in the office and, you know, 40 hours a week on the movie as well on top of that. And so that was like that for several years. I guess it's not evident in the movie that I'm hoping the movie is fun, even if the struggle making it was more harrowing than anything else.
So did you have any problems getting any of your actors return over such a long period of time?
Less than you'd think. They were in, the actors showed up when they had to and when somebody had to be replaced or doubled, you just get away with it. I mean, there was somebody who was doubled that you'd never be able to notice in the movie and, they weren't available anymore. And luckily that was already written into the script to compensate for it. So it's fine.
Can I guess which actor that might be?
You can guess, but I won't confirm it one way or the other. How's that?
Okay. I'm pretty sure I know who it is, but we'll discuss that off air maybe later. You have a ton of locations, and I mean a ton for an indie film. Usually it's, well, we can say it these way. I can say the basement's the majority of the film.
It's about 25 minutes of the movie takes place in the basement.
Right. And the apartments are a good section of the film.
Correct.
But you go all over the place, a hospital, an office, a supermarket, and outdoor shots.
Yep.
How did you get all that with no money?
Well, if I had done it in New York, it would have been impossible. But when you shoot in Philadelphia, this is going to be an elaborate sort of answer. So the tax credit in Pennsylvania is so bad that it's only $60 million a year, which you'd be like, that sounds like a lot of money. Well, it's not. It means that every production in Pennsylvania has up to $60 million a year. And the backlog is so terrible that, you know, you apply now and in 4 years, they'll look at your case and you're going to have to, you know, put up the money for the accounting side of it just to get your 25% back. If you can get it, if you can get approved, and you're going to have to put up something like between $3,000 and $5,000. So there's no reason for anybody to make a movie there. You might get one mainstream movie a year made in the entire state. And what that means is people are less savvy about charging for locations. People are like, oh, I just want to be in a movie. I just want to help out. That sounds awesome. Oh, I get to be in a big Hollywood thing. And you're like, look, I know this is a SAG production, but there's nothing about this. It's a big Hollywood thing at all. If I told you what this cost, you'd be like, really? You got away with all that for that little money? And I'd say, yeah, but, you know, that's why you have so much, I guess, production value in a sense. But there's so many locations because it was just necessary. I made the mistake when I wrote the script that the initial drafts, which I wasn't intending to direct the movie, had far more locations, like 70. And there was about 100 speaking parts. And the first draft was like 142 pages. The shooting draft was 99 and the movie runs 96 pre-closing credits, which I'm actually more proud of than almost anything else, considering how condensed a lot of the material is. It just seemed necessary to tie everything together to show like how the city was deteriorating, to show as many places as possible and to have as many characters just to get as many different perspectives. But basically, to answer your question, it has to do with the Pennsylvania tax credit being so miserable that nobody is savvy enough to charge a ton for locations. That's why.
Perfect. That's good. I do find your film has a little bit of a change. You have a scene right at the beginning of the film that involves nudity.
Mm-hmm.
And you never seem to go back to that kind of genre, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. The film never goes back that way. It seems to totally divert into a different kind of film. Was that originally planned?
That scene was originally on page 40, and my script supervisor, Justine Harrison, said, you need to start with something big. And I thought, okay, well, it was originally written to be kind of a pointed commentary on the way that men and women are treated in horror films, in which the woman gets it in the worst way possible, and the man gets stabbed in the stomach and shoved off screen. And that always seemed underwhelming to me. And so I thought, what is a scene in where I can make the audience terribly uncomfortable for long, especially one, horror audiences who tend to be male? What is a scene I can make them terribly uncomfortable? And then for the next 10 minutes, I can lay out my exposition because they'll still be kind of traumatized. And the opening scene is deliberately baroque. It was, okay, how big can I go and exaggerated and ridiculous where people will kind of get that it's a bit over the top and funny while also playing around with the genre tropes that are, that you expect in a scene like that and then kind of flip it around.
But I guess what I'm trying to say is that violence that we see at the beginning never appears in anything else through the film. You seem to sort of bring it right back down to more of a normalcy.
Well, there's a couple other violent sequences at the beginning. There's a chase in an alleyway that's pretty violent.
Yes.
And then there's a couple other sequences, a musical montage that's pretty violent.
Yes.
About 15, 20 minutes later. But it's true there isn't as much violence after that. The earlier drafts really had much more, and it's just exhausting to have that much. You just wear everybody out. And some people have said, the movie kind of slows down in the midway point. And I said, did you really want that breakneck pace for the entire 100 minutes? Because I could do it, but it would be kind of an empty rush. You know, you wouldn't learn anything about anybody, and it would be just you'd kind of feel completely like, all right, what was the point of that? You know, it would be just a sugar high initially, and I guess I could do it, but you know, I wasn't interested as much in fulfilling all the genre tropes only. I mean, you make a horror film because it's an entry point. You don't have to have big stars. People will watch a horror film even if it's got technical limitations or budgetary limitations. And as long as you fulfill the tropes, your nudity, your violence, your certain levels of stuff, you can kind of do whatever you want. One of my main influences was the Japanese women in prison movie, Female Comic Scorpion, which is the best women in prison movie ever made. And in the midst of what is all the things that you got to do in a women in prison movie, which is you must have the sadistic warden, you must have the lesbian scenes, you must have the cat fights, you must have the, you know, attempted rapes, you must have all of those things. It is a brilliant and scathing commentary on the Japanese patriarchy in the 70s. And it's also a surrealist masterpiece with bizarre camera work that doesn't even make any sense. You and I mean, I used to be a film critic and you're one now. I've seen thousands of movies, you know, and have never seen a movie like that where I could not tell you where the camera was watching Female Comic Scorpion. Every time I show it to someone, they're like, oh my God, this is a great film. I'm like, I know it's great. You can finally see it. It took so long, but this is a fabulous movie. And I thought to myself, right, so these guys, I read enough about the film, and Kill Bill steals a little bit from it, but, I read enough about the film where I was like, okay, so what they had was they were the third movie on a triple bill and in the 70s. And so as long as they have the minimum things that need to be in a women prison movie, the rest is for what they want to do with it. The rest is for what they feel like doing. And so I was under the same impression that as long as I do the things that I have to do, now it's not that I did it cynically. I mean, there's always an element of cynicism in it, but that as long as I had the nudity and the violence and all this other stuff, the rest of the movie is for me. It's for me to have fun or to make whatever point I want to make or to make the dumb jokes that I want to make or to show off the animation or whatever variety that I feel like doing. As long as the 14-year-old boy is satisfied, the rest of it is broccoli. And if they get annoyed at it, they got sucked in. And at that point, I guess it's not my problem. But since you want to appeal to as many people as you can, all right, here's the thing. Can I do the trope well? Can I execute it well where you are shocked? Can I do the thing? Can it be baroque and over the top? Can it be silly? Can it be all the things? Can I succeed at the minimum of what I'm doing and still enjoy it? Even if obviously shooting the horror sequences is obviously often more complicated with makeup and having to slow down and camera work and the special effects and all that stuff takes a lot out of you and takes more planning. Can we do that part well while still making the movie that I want to make? And so the movie can be accused of being all over the place because, in essence, it does the basics requirements and then essentially moves on from there while still trying to tell the same story, if that answers your question.
It does, totally. I got to back this up. You just dropped some knowledge on me. Who were you a film critic for?
Oh, 10 years ago. Well, I started out in high school for my school paper and wrote for some magazines in the early aughts. And then Had my own website. I wrote for a newspaper in Columbus, Ohio called Outlook Weekly. And that eventually got me to, when I moved to Philadelphia, I had my own website, which is Regrettable Moments Sincerity. And then I got in Rotten Tomatoes. And then, I started doing, you know, I was in like 9 places at once. So I was on Examiner, which is like, you know, citizen journalism. So I was voted like one of the top 20 critics in America, and they flew me out to Denver to shoot a commercial. But I got to, you know, what would happen with film criticism with me is that I would get burned out, because it's really easy to happen, really easy to get burned out, because all the movies kind of seem the same. And after 2 or 3 years, you're like, I don't need any more of this. And it doesn't, you know, I came in and out of periods where you could make some money, and then eventually there was no way to make any money doing it. So it was not, there was nothing to sustain. Like, I had my own podcast for a couple of years, and I'm a kind of, when I would interview people, I'm like a really tough interviewer, like, because I'm very confrontational. And I want people to have a good time, but I throw people off. And so I enjoyed that part of it, but the writing was not as much fun anymore. And then eventually just got burned out. In fact, the script for this basically came out of like a self-imposed, I don't want to write about film anymore. And then I just, you know, had this idea based on an initial conversation with someone where they said, hey, I want to write a zombie movie. And I said, why would you do that? Just make a virus movie and make up your own rules. What's the difference? And he wasn't interested. And so I wrote it. And so it came out of that. So yeah, the film criticism helped me to understand all the different genre tropes, and it helped me to know what not to do. I find that watching bad movies is instructional. Watching good movies is helpful to a point, and watching great movies is depressing. And you should never do that as a filmmaker, because great movies are inexplicable. And whatever isn't working in the movie becomes irrelevant. You know, even when it's glaring, I had that experience while we were in post-production a couple of times going to see in my local theater. They played the director's cut of Amadeus, and I went to go see the movie, and there's like a really glaringly bad part. And it's the Elizabeth Barrage part, the wife. She's really bad in the film, but the rest of the film is so great that it really makes no difference. Like, it's such a great commentary on mediocrity, and it's the worst thing you could watch while you're making a movie, as Amadeus, because the whole thing is someone reveling and being upset about their own mediocrity. And there you are having the same dilemma, and going, how do I get past this? Like, I'm feeling as mediocre as Salieri is, but it's same thing happens. Like, anytime you watch, like, I went to see Alien in the theater and had the same experience. I'm like, God, there's some really glaring flaws in this movie, terrible stuff, and it does not matter. This thing is working. All of this is inexplicable. When I remember this very specifically, when my DP came to drop some footage off, Universal HD was playing Fast Times at Ridgemont High, and we were just caught it in the middle, and we watched a couple scenes, and we were noticing all the technical mistakes, all the problems, and we turned to each other and go, "What's weird is that none of this matters. This movie's working." It doesn't make any difference that, look, that shot doesn't match. You know, the ADR is bad here. The lips aren't, you know, working. They crossed the 180. It doesn't make any difference. And because it's just all, it's all inexplicable about why something really works and whether it doesn't. And that's probably one of the more frustrating things about making a movie is you could be doing everything right and it doesn't matter.
Okay, we'll get back to your movie now. Sorry to say.
Okay, I realize that I'll give you a lot, whatever you ask.
Yeah, which is great. There's no issues. How's working with blood as a director?
Not my favorite thing. I wanted to shoot practical effects as much as possible, because years ago I had seen The Raid, and I thought the CGI blood looked so bad in that I thought, that don't do that. You know, there are two things that were influential on me. One was in terms of don't do that. One was The Raid, and the other was John Wick, because I don't like the way that John Wick looks. I don't like how that became a fashion, that every scene has to be color graded to the point of its own. It's so saturated, there's just one color in the scene. I really don't like that. And then it became, that's what everyone does. And I find it kind of, not just everything looking the same, but kind of ugly. But with the blood question, it was, I thought, okay, let's do it on. And then you realize when you're shooting a horror film on set that there's so many problems that occur with the effects that you can't control, and they're not necessarily the fault of anybody individually. And then you get into post-production and you realize how cheap After Effects are to do, hiring someone else to do it. I'm not an expert in that. And then you learn what it costs and you're like, that's it. I could have done this whole thing. You know, the opening scene was that was one day, just that one side of it. We shot for basically 19 or 20 days, but, that was the last thing that was shot, was just sort of the 30 seconds in the one room. The other side of it was shot several years before. And then, you know, the initial scene walking through the hallway, that was shot, you know, several years before and just combined. But, that was planned and storyboarded to death, and it didn't work on the day. And a lot of that is fixed in post-production. And I don't think you can tell. I think it's pretty seamless, honestly. And I was very shocked how cheap it was to accomplish. It makes you rethink, okay, you know, the problem of, that I think of is something like the John Carpenter version of The Thing, which has the best practical effects that I've ever seen, I think. And then you watch the 2011 version, which looked dated in 2011, because they used all that CG. It looks horrible. And I didn't like the movie then, and I can't imagine it looks great 10 years later. But that was also part of the thought process, is CGI, especially when it's low budget, looks dated really quickly. So you better not focus on it. But it turned out there's like 60, 65 effects in my film. And most of them are so subtle you'd never notice. I mean, some of them are just covering products and labels and stuff. But other things are pretty subtle, and no one ever would even, you know, pay the money mind.
So I noticed that maybe nobody else has. You put eating sounds as the zombies are eating. I definitely noticed eating sounds constantly. Was that something that you consciously were thinking of, that zombies need to make a sound while they eat?
Well, I understand the confusion, but there actually is no undead in the film. There's nobody who comes back to life after they're already dead.
It
has the appearance of a zombie film. The subject is broached, but I don't want anyone to be confused and think that they're going to see, you know, the slow zombies, the fast zombies. This is literally just a reaction to disease. But I don't get angry at the comparison, because I totally understand it. Because the movie has to acknowledge the idea that zombies are at least in the consciousness in some way or another. To ignore it, I think, would be, I don't know, naive, honestly. Absolutely. But to answer your question about the eating, it's basically because they're trying to get liquids. I mean, and people are, you know, they're indiscriminate. Their brains aren't working. That's sort of the short answer of that.
So you wouldn't call it, what did you call your creatures then, if they're not zombies?
Just infected.
So okay.
An infected person. In the script, that's how it is. And then there was someone who said, I want to play a zombie, and I didn't correct them, because that's fine. Because it really, the difference between a vampire movie and a zombie movie and a viral pandemic movie and all this stuff is really just a matter of, you know, tweaking something slightly. It's not honestly any different. I mean, the title is not a reference to the famous radio show. It's a reference to the scene that's in all those movies. So there's always a scene in every one of those movies where someone is turned and they're talking to a family member and they're like, you know, wait, don't kill me. That's what that is. That's a reference to that. Now, I think that's the worst scene in any of those movies, because it's so predictable, and every single one of them is boring. I'm like, oh, I know where this is going. And so I said, I will have that as the title, but I will never have that scene in there, because I do not like it. And I know it's sort of mandatory. So maybe that's my little nod in a sense. But if someone thinks, oh, that's a cute reference to the radio show, I'm not going to disabuse them of that. That's fine.
So I also want to go, you have a scene with the general talking to, I think it's the head nurse or the head doctor or something, and they asked about Chinese food. Mm-hmm. And then when they leave the room, the woman goes, why is he asking Chinese food? He goes, well, wouldn't it be weird if he asked about Mexican food or soul food? Wouldn't that be racist?
Yes. The point of that is Chinese food is inoffensive no matter where you are. The point is, wouldn't it be more accurate to this neighborhood? Because they're, you know, if it were Mexican or soul food, which is true, because I wrote it about the neighborhood I lived in, which is Germantown, and which is next to Nicetown. That is a real place in Philadelphia. So that is what he said, is that he gives this speech about Chinese food, because no matter where you are in any city in America, everyone's like, oh, I know a Chinese food place. And it could just be in any old, you know, rinky dink city or suburb or wherever. But if there's a soul food restaurant, you know where you are.
I thought that was brilliant. That's what I wanted to say. Really like that line. It made me laugh.
Good.
Also, I want to discuss, I really like the handouts under the door. I'd never seen that before. I thought that was a neat trick.
I have a thing about putting notes everywhere. I think that's a, I think that's a sneaky way of doing exposition. Cause one of my big goals is always to, how do we get exposition across without it seeming like two doctors dryly explaining? So the scene you just mentioned is basically functions as exposition.
Yeah.
The scene with a scene where they're talking about all the things the disease does and how they're going to protect it and how they don't really care. They just worried about, the bad press, about the death count and about like how, you know, yeah, these are poor people and they're closely packed together and they're brown, you know, black and brown. And do we really care that they're the victims? No, we don't. What is that other than exposition? Of course that's what it is. But then the animation sequence is just purely exposition. And when you have a sci-fi movie or a horror film or any, you know, sort of, premise that needs to be explained further than just like these are two people talking in a room, you're going to have a lot of exposition. So because that's the curse of the screenwriter is having to deal with how do you get the exposition out. I was like, all right, the exposition scenes have to be fun then. They have to be silly. They never, no acknowledging them as exposition, but just find different ways to do it, hence the animation. So the hospital scenes really just function that way, but I wanted them to be either gross or entertaining or both.
So you keep harping on the animation. I haven't got there yet.
Okay.
How long did it take the animation to get done and who did it?
Ellen Marcus, who designed the poster. Well, there's now two posters. We had the poster that you have behind you, but there's another second poster that was a little tamer that was designed recently. She did the storyboards and she did the poster first. We actually did the poster and the storyboards, the poster, and we did a teaser before we started shooting anything. But she did the animation. The first sequence took a couple of months, maybe 6 months, I think. And then, there's a second animated sequence and that was actually not scripted. What happened is I needed to fill a hole. I had a sequence that was written, but we couldn't get the location we wanted. And she said, I could just rotoscope that. I said, you can? And she's like, sure. And post-production took so long that she had forever to work on it. And my favorite sequence in the whole movie is the dream sequence anyway. It has, if you watch it a second time, I know you've seen it the once, if you watch it again, there is so much detail in there. It is in a minute 20, there are so many jokes that were scripted and then she would throw in things that I hadn't scripted and I was just like, it was the proudest moment watching every stage of that. Like, oh my God, like I'm not emotional, but I was pretty near tears watching the early drafts of that because I was like, this is so much better than what the two paragraphs I wrote in the first draft. Basically what happened is the first draft had this ridiculous sequence that is basically what the animated sequence is. And then, cause I didn't think I was going to have to make the movie. And then when I had to make the movie, the later drafts became a little bit more realistic and like, how can you shoot that? And then by the sixth draft, which was the shooting draft, I had something that was considerably more palatable that you could actually shoot, although it was still a bit absurd and ridiculous. And then we couldn't get the location we wanted. And you know, it was just like, okay, how do we do this? We need this buffer sequence. So she said, I'll rotoscope it. And I just said, great, run wild with it. Do whatever you want. And the only corrections I would ever make is like, okay, add a little bit more brown in the water here. But you know, the monsters, the style, all the stuff that you see, that's mostly just her. Like I had a couple of paragraphs that had all the jokes in it, but you know, she just kept going. I had the idea of synchronized swimming zombies and I always wanted to put it in something. And so that was what that initial idea was. And she said, no, I gave her, you know, video footage of the actors to rotoscope over and she just ran with it. And that one took a couple of months too, but since you're in post-production, you're not in a rush. So it was fine.
So you have a scene that has a canoe in it.
Yes.
So I'm not ruining anything. How much did you have to row the canoe down the river or did you just place it there?
Well, we were at actually the canoe club in Philadelphia.
Oh, okay.
So it was fine. They had them. So we didn't have to actually grab it. It was the location we got permission to shoot at was actually the Philadelphia Canoe Club, which you can see on a sign kind of briefly there, which I wasn't going to change. Because that's fine. They can get the free advertising. That's okay.
No.
I wouldn't expect anybody to notice it. But yeah, that's actually a canoe club. That was always supposed to be a sequence on water. Water's a big thing throughout the film.
Oh yeah, water's a definitely big thing. Mm-hmm. You do also want to discuss one scene. You have, I think it's Angelique.
Chapman plays Cheryl.
She has to climb through, she comes down over, two guys are sitting on a bench. She climbs over and has to go through like a drainage pipe.
Yep. a culvert. Yeah.
How low were you on that scene? Were you having problems? Because, I mean, it looks like you might be on rocks or something shooting that.
She had to climb down and then go into that culvert, and we had a camera to the side above as she did it from one angle. Well, yeah, so sort of like low angle as she entered it. And then we had another camera on the other side of the water as she went in there. In fact, there was when she gets through the other side, there was supposed to be a very elaborate slapstick gag. But in fact, that was a much longer sequence that we cut down that involved her flying out in the background of a shot. While the people there to pick her up don't even notice that she's there. And it was supposed to be a complete slapstick thing where they're looking around and in the background out of focus is a body flying into the air and hitting the ground. But since we were shooting for real, that couldn't really be done. We thought, oh, let's get a mattress in there. Let's get the stuntman, blah, blah, blah. But stuntman wasn't available that day. And I'm like, you know, do we need to pile on more stuff to make this more complicated? And I thought not. So we just simplified it. In editing, you know, a lot of the extra details, a lot of the kind of cutesy jokes. Like, you can't believe how many dumb jokes I wrote that got cut out of the movie. Probably about 100. That were in the script that were shot that just got pulled out, and I have no regrets about pulling them out at all. Seeing the sequences without the jokes, I'm like, I don't care. That's fine. There's too much stuff in this movie already to cut out just one of my, you know, self-indulgent jokes is fine with me.
I just want to go to casting back. I know you discussed this at the beginning, but we've kind of gone a little off track since then. Now, you couldn't get the cast you wanted in Philly, and then you went to New York is what I'm understanding.
Correct.
Did you have anybody you used from local Philly, or everybody is New York based?
Yeah. So the general is the only person that was from the original casting session that ended up in the movie. The problem that I created by writing the script the way that I did is so Germantown and Nicetown do not look like me, a white guy. It looks like who's cast in the movie. That's what it looks like when you live there. And I did not want to have another in a series of screaming dead white teenager horror films. That's what everyone makes. And so when I tried to cast in Philadelphia the first time, all I got were the one role who's a white girl in her 20s. I got like hundreds of tapes on that, tons of them. And it was like, okay, great. And I didn't end up using them. The woman who I cast, Risa Rocket Priori, she's from Connecticut, and she happened to be overhearing that there was an audition like in the place we were auditioning in New York. And she's like, hey, can I audition? And she just blew us away. So it was like, okay, yeah. Yeah, I remember the second when we came back for callbacks, it was just perfunctory because she absolutely had it. But everybody auditioned for that one white girl in 20s because that's most actresses. But the problem I had was that the lead was a Hispanic man in his 40s and a black woman in her late 30s as the wife. And it was like, okay, how do you cast this? Because nobody writes roles for these people, they don't exist in the industry anymore. So it becomes very difficult to cast. And because everybody is typecast all the time, I remember this very specifically. There's a guy who wanted to audition for the main character, Gilberto, when we were shooting, when we were attending to make the film in Philadelphia the first time in 2014. And we were on the phone and he said, do you want me to do it with a Hispanic accent? And I said, do you have a Hispanic accent? And he said, no, but I can do one. And I said, if you don't have one, don't do one, because just audition as you. There's nothing about that you have to play a stereotype here. In fact, he's written not to be – he's just written to be a guy. He's written to be just, you know, a loving father trying to learn to be a chef, but he's a garbage man right now, and, he would like to improve. And that's what he's about. And he's, you know, he's brave, but he in certain situations, he's a bit bigger, you know, he's more muscular than he might be, thoughtful at times. I mean, that's part of the way the character is built. But I don't want you to do – anything that is out of the ordinary or to play into a stereotype. And that's the mindset that most actors who are minorities they get typecast into that role. And then if they got to play a role just to be themselves, they just don't exist, you know, unless they're pigeonholed, you know, or specifically placed for politically correct reasons. I didn't cast a movie in politically correct reasons. It's like, no, that's what that place looks like. Why would I change it? It wouldn't make any sense. I mean, a part of the point is that the government wouldn't care because of who the victims are. You can't cast it with a bunch of, you know, white people. It wouldn't make any sense, especially if it's taking place in the inner city. The only thing I wanted to have was more college students, but it didn't end up, you know, working out that way. I wanted a lot of the extras to be college students and older people, because in my mind, that was in the after gentrification occurs, and, you know, and or there's after there's white flight, after white flight, the only people left in those areas are college kids and older people who are poor who can't afford to leave, and college kids who need housing. So I wanted more of that. So that's not as much in the movie, although it's a little bit of subtext, but it's not really all that evident.
Go ahead. Keep going. I won't stop.
Okay. Sure. So the casting became easier to cast in New York because there were more Hispanic and black actors of various ages. So I was not even getting any applicants. And when I did, it would be sort of this depressing conversation about how gay do you want me to be? How black do you want me to be? How Hispanic do you want me to be? And I didn't have to have that conversation in New York. And I don't know if that's a problem of there's just not many productions in Pennsylvania because of the tax credit. And so there's just not as much experience. I sense that that's probably true. That there's not as much experience. All the actors who live in Philadelphia had to travel to New York all the time to get regular work anyway. So anybody that we cast out of Philadelphia, which is mostly the smaller parts and the extras, you know, I'm pretty specific about what I'm looking for. So I would give a lot of help, not on set. I'm not like directing heavily on set. It's like, you know, I'll talk to people. I'll call up an extra and I'll say, look, this is what I need from you. You know, the extra in the first scene, who has the most traumatic part in the film. We had a 20-minute conversation on the phone, and he was the only – I talked to probably 15 extras on the phone before I knew that I got the right guy, because most people would not play that part once they knew what it was. And I'd get, well, I have family. Oh, okay. Well, I'm a Christian. I don't know what that has to do with it. Well, you know, the conversations that I had were like, okay, then don't do it. It's all right. And then the first person, Freddie Colton, who plays that role – I described it to him. And it's like, that's pretty funny. I'm like, you get it then. You understand. He's like, no, I totally do that. And so that's why he's in the movie, because he understood that it was supposed to be over the top and funny. So I'm pretty specific about this stuff, but yeah, most of the cast had to be from New York. Just, I think it's an experience thing. And just, also what I did with the casting was different, in which, the movie as written is, each character had like two scenes that they could just work on, that they had like, okay, you got monologues, so the script is written in a particular way, which is the descriptions are very florid. They're very purple. They're very visceral. And the dialogue is written like a play, because I wanted to differentiate it from how boring screenplays generally are to read, when you read them. And so how do I stick out? Cause I'm a nobody. Nobody's going to make this movie unless it's me, or unless it stands out in some way. So the actors loved reading the sides, because it was like, here's the first scene where you show off, and here's the second scene where you show off. The first scene you're auditioning with this one, and then when you come back the second time, you're going to audition with the other scene. And almost all of that dialogue was shot verbatim from the original auditions. Did all of it end up in the movie? No. But everybody knew, I knew what they could do because they were already performing the line. So yeah, you go through as much rehearsal as you can, which is really important. But when we got on set, I didn't have to do so much directing because I already knew they could do it, and they knew they could do it. There was very little necessity for consulting, because it was like, all right, I already hired you for this because you did those exact scenes. There's almost no changes unless someone said to me, can I change this? Because this is a little hard to say. I'm like, absolutely. All I want in this scene is this plot point to come out and this joke to come out. If we get there, it's easier for you to say, just do that. That's fine. So rarely, unless there was a mistake, like a technical mistake, did I ever do more than four takes, because you just wear people out. I'm not big into that Robert Bresson's Kubrick thing where you wear an actor out until they're giving you like only who they are as a person. I'm like, it's a low budget movie. I mean, I'm essentially typecasting to a point anyway. I'm casting based on what I see when I talk to them, whether I think I can get along with them on set and whether they think they can do the part. So I'm trusting they can do the part, and you know, when they usually perform on set, I'm just, you know, I'm not dictatorial at all. And I think that helps relax people.
Okay. Last thing, your music. It's evidently throughout the movie, you love music. So you created it, didn't you?
So I didn't compose the film. The film was composed, the score was composed by Jeffrey Waterman. I basically gave him the direction of, I know everyone does dark wave scores, but yours is really good, so do that as well. The opening song, parentheses by The Blow, was basically a juxtaposition. Like, I needed something silly and poppy to juxtapose with the violence in the opening sequence. And I did write one song. I didn't write the music. I just wrote the lyrics for a song, a cooking show theme. And originally what I had wanted was Banana Phone by Raffi. And I sent an email to Raffi's people, and once they learned it was a horror film, they said no. So I knew that I would have to come up with something myself. So I wrote the lyrics, and that was actually, funny enough, the song was composed 2.5 years after that sequence was shot. So the composer and the guy who sang the song to my lyrics, Cookie Rabinowitz, what he did was actually perform to the cut sequence, which is a very strange way to make a song, because he had to match it up with what was already done. And it's, you know, it's pretty close. And since it's not supposed to be a perfect sync, he just read the lyrics and matched it up in that way, which is, as I said, a very strange way of doing it. But all I did, I didn't do any of it personally except for write the lyrics and hire the individual people to do it. But I think the score is one of the best elements in the film. It's really atmospheric. And I like the silly thing that Cookie did. I think that fits the mood exactly what I was after, which is what if a Harry Connick Jr. knockoff sang a song about going to a restaurant and getting all the condiments and pouring it in a soup like high school kids do, but you're an adult and you can get away with it. So that was the conception there. That sequence where the song plays it has so much going on, and I don't expect anybody necessarily pay attention to the lyrics, but that's the premise of the song.
Are you ready for some fun questions?
Absolutely.
Your favorite film? I know this could be a good one because you've seen everything.
My favorite film is Steven Soderbergh's Schizopolis, which he made in 1997, starring him and his ex-wife at the time. And it is a satire on consumerism, on Scientology, and on language and the way people express themselves. And one of my favorite things is movies that take big swings. And if they don't hit, I don't care. I like things with ideas. I like things that try out things, and even if it doesn't work. One of my favorite movies from recent years is Sorry to Bother You, which takes huge swings. And I genuinely do not mind if it doesn't work at times, because I'm like, be bold. Who cares? You're not going to be for everybody, and it doesn't matter. So Schizopolis is like that. About half of it really works, and about the other half doesn't. My other favorite film is something like Noah Baumbach's Kicking and Screaming.
Early Baumbach.
Yeah, no, I really that really nails what it's like to be just graduating with a liberal arts degree, in terms of that feeling of the difference between being a senior in college about to graduate and the next day being just an unemployed loser is about 24 hours. And he absolutely nails that. And so I watched that one frequently. The dialogue is so sharp in that movie. But you know, anything that we all have our eras where things were most influential on us. It's usually anything you saw between the ages of like 16 and 25. So anything I saw like the early 90s to the early aughts is going to be more influential, like, you know, Charlie Kaufman stuff. Although none of it is really evident. Like the most influential movies on the film itself are Tom Noonan's What Happened Was, Female Convict Scorpion, and Jonathan Demme's Something Wild. Although if you watch the movie, you wouldn't know, you wouldn't be like, oh, were you inspired by Shaun of the Dead? Sort of.
But not only, really. No, only, I don't see that in your film at all.
No, but everyone thinks that. And I would say, well, it's a little bit, but not in any way you would think of.
No.
You know, or Cabin in the Woods. No, I didn't want to go self-aware. You know, I was not interested in being self-aware at all. Like, I love Cabin in the Woods, but I think that's a crutch. Where once you break the fourth wall, you can't have any tension anymore. Now, Cabin in the Woods gets away with it, which is a miracle, but I don't think anytime you do that, you help yourself. And because horror comedy is already so hard to pull off, there's only like, you know, 15 good ones.
Probably.
Yeah, Evil Dead 2, Reanimator, Tucker and Dale versus Evil, Drag Me to Hell, you know, Cabin in the Woods. I mean, we're kind of running short, right, at that point?
Yeah. Idle Hands.
Yeah, that doesn't hold up so well. There's some good stuff in it, but
I'm trying to think. I'm trying to help you out here. Number two.
Go ahead.
You've seen probably more films than I have, which I don't meet too many people. So your favorite soundtrack?
When I listen to scores. You know, I would listen to some David Julian stuff, like for Solaris, the remake of Solaris, and some Cliff Martinez, his early Soderbergh collaborations I like. It's hard to know. I don't know if I have, you know, one that I would, you know, Morricone's for The Thing I like very much. You know, I like John Ottman's score for The Usual Suspects, but I guess I don't listen to as much score. I mean, if you're just going to listen to the score, the obvious answer is Daft Punk's Tron Legacy score, which is like 50 times better than the movie.
Yeah, 100%.
And you can still listen to it now, and it's fabulous, and you're like, great, I don't need to see 1 second of that movie ever again.
Nope,
and
I agree.
I still listen to the score 10 years later if I needed to work to it. I mean, I generally work to, like, Metric or Ben Folds, but if the Tron Legacy soundtrack is on, I'll work to that. That's fine. It's super catchy. I mean, I'm not big into that style necessarily, but that's the best that exists of it, certainly.
Okay, so you've made films, you've written about films, you've watched – thousands of films. Is there still one film you've never seen that you need to?
I'm sure. I mean, I don't watch the comic book movies at all. They just do not interest me. I find them genuinely very safe and boring. I didn't watch Swallow yet. I thought I should, but we watched Butt Boy, which is like the same thing, right? If you know Swallow, the one about the woman who's like swallowing all the objects. And we watch Butt Boy, which is like the same thing, except the guy puts things in his butt. Which works about half the time. The opening is great. And then it falls off a little bit in the middle. I'm trying to think if there's something in particular that, like, you have your holy grails and then you just watch them. I don't think about it that way, I guess. There's not a great movie that I think, oh, I should see it, and I don't watch it. There's plenty of things where someone might go, hey, you should absolutely see that, and I'll go, it's not really in my wheelhouse. I don't like war movies. Biopics I'm not a fan of. I don't think that you could make a biopic anymore after Walk Hard. It seems utterly pointless because you have already parodied that. There is no point in doing it straight anymore. So I'm already not a fan of biopics because – it seems to me that if they go through the cliches of the drama, except that it's about a famous person. But I'm sure there's plenty of biopics that I should have seen that I haven't. I've seen bits and pieces of things that won Best Picture and just never cared to finish them. I don't know if I've ever finished A Beautiful Mind. I don't think I'm missing anything necessarily. I don't know if you got something offhand. Have you seen this? And I might go, no, but it's not something I would.
I just wanted to pick your brain. That was just a total pick your brain question.
I mean, there's probably some Billy Wilder movies that I should watch that I haven't seen. A big Billy Wilder fan. Just saw The Apartment again recently. What an amazing movie that is. I saw Ace in the Hole like 15 years ago, and I could not believe that wasn't like available widely. I'm very happy that finally got a wide, Criterion release. That's one of the best movies. I mean, all I could say, like, as a critic, and you probably experience the same thing, you really aren't worried about what you haven't seen. You worry about what other people haven't seen. You want to share all the things that other people should see. So I would say, hey, go watch What Happened Was. Hey, go watch Something Wild or Female Comic Scorpion or the first that, Female Comic Scorpion is a sequel. Watch the first one. It's also very, very, very good. Or watch the original Old Boy, or watch The Third Man, or watch, Battle Royale, or Kicking and Screaming, or Rushmore, or This is Spinal Tap, or, anything that I'd like, I would absolutely go back to that whenever. Or, most people haven't seen Paul Thomas Anderson's first film, Hard Eight, which is one of my favorite films. I don't think of a thing that I'm missing that I haven't seen because I would just, it's so easily accomplished now to watch something. Just turn on the TV and there it is streaming on whatever platform, or you have a disc or you whatever the thing is. It's really just making the time. So unfortunately I didn't quite answer your question. I'm sure there's lots of things that I haven't seen, but that I don't feel like I missed it.
Perfect. Your film will be released today, October 23rd. Where can they find it?
It would be playing on the Lemley Theater's website, virtually streaming. So you go to lemley.com or just lemley.com and then, you'll click on, watch now or whatever it looks like, cause the theaters aren't open in Los Angeles and you'll be able to watch it at home. You just go through the process, good, enjoy your 102 minutes, I guess.
Thank you for your time and have a great day.
Thanks very much.